You can guess and clap. All right, is everyone awake? Extra hour of sleep? We feeling good? Okay, pretty good. Walt's clapping back there. I got you, Walt. I see you. Who here was at Pumpkin Bash? Raise your hand. Okay, pretty good. Pumpkin Bash, extra hour of sleep this weekend. It's a good weekend. You should be feeling good. Hey, if you're new with us, my name is Mark Lohman, the associate pastor here at New Life Community Church, and I'll kind of let you into my my inner mind this morning, which hopefully doesn't scare you. But I am a planner. I love planning. I love envisioning each and every step of my future. I love strategizing. I love thinking ahead and kind of arranging all the details, so to speak. Rachel, my wife, she's very similar to this. I think this is probably why, in a lot of different ways, we're a perfect match. We both love planning ahead, details, and strategizing. So I think maybe we've done this before, I don't know. Rachel and I could probably spend hours at a coffee shop and just thinking and dreaming and planning where we want to be 5 years from now, 15 years from now, 20 years from now. It's just us. We love doing that. And so we already know the names of our future kids. We know when we want to have them. And no, Rachel's not pregnant right now. I know I'm probably going to be asked that after this. But we even know some of the hobbies that we want them to participate in. Right? So Rachel wants a girl, and she needs to be a pageant girl. I want a boy. I want it to be a baseball player. No, we're not going to be those parents who, like, force their kids to, like, live my dream that I never achieved or something like that. But the even crazier thing is, on our wedding day, we didn't really have a wedding coordinator, so I think Rachel kind of took up that role. And so she produced this beautiful 4-page document that was probably one of the most detailed things I've ever seen. And so it had that whole day ordered out in its schedule. And it started at 8:50 in the morning, and it went to, I think, a past 11 p.m., I believe. And so she had things like each and every bridesmaid and her wedding party, the exact time that they were getting their hair done, right? She had the exact time that our wedding cake was supposed to arrive at our venue. The best part about all of this is that not only is Rachel detailed and she did an amazing job, but that she never, like, got that stressed out. She was entirely composed. If you know wedding planning, you know that there's a nickname for brides called Bridezilla. Rachel was completely not a Bridezilla, and it would have made it that much more better. She did awesome. And I could even mention, like, the spreadsheet that I designed for our earlier trip to New York City. So wedding planning, spreadsheets for vacation trips, future names of our kids, where and what we'll be doing 5 years from now, 15 years from now, 30 years from now. It's all silly. It's cute. But it's interesting because I look at that and I kind of examined myself this past week. All of that, good stuff, it's really kind of like a microcosm or a small little sample, I think, of our culture of independence and wanting to control every little thing. I desire that. I like to be in control. And it's no wonder then for wedding planning that we have a nickname that is Bridezilla, and that these poor girls, for the day that they're looking forward to their whole life, they completely freak out and stress out because they want every single detail to go right. And of course, something is always going to go wrong. We're all finite, limited, dependent creatures. We can't be in complete control. And so our scripture this morning, I think, is so fitting. Like, it so much speaks into American culture for our desire for control. So if you've been with us, you know that we've been in the book of James. Ryan mentioned that in his prayer. And we're actually getting to the last chapter. So I'm going to go ahead and read our passage out loud for us. If you don't have a Bible, we would love just to give you a free one. They're underneath the chairs in front of you. I'll be reading from them. They look like this. I'll be on page 849, and we'll also put it on the TV screens behind me. So James chapter 4, starting at verse 13, we are just in four verses this morning, so it's a small passage. Okay, follow along with me. Verse 13. Now listen, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go to this or that city, spend a year there, carry on business, and make some money. Why, you do not even know what will happen tomorrow. What is your life? You are a mist that appears for a little while and then vanishes. Instead, you ought to say, if it's the Lord's will, we will live and do this or do that. As it is, you boast in your arrogant schemes. All such boasting is evil. If anyone then knows the good they ought to do and doesn't do it, it is sin for them. Okay, thank you, James. I don't know about you guys, but I actually think this series has actually been pretty tough. I wasn't here last Sunday. I was visiting my grandma for her 90th birthday. But it seems like every Sunday, like, James actually, like, challenges us pretty deeply, right? And I remember kind of planning out this series months and months ago when we were doing that, and it was like, hey, here's this perfect little short little book full of practical advice, right? We really want our faith community, we want to get our hands and feet dirty for the kingdom. Like, we want to follow Jesus in Artesia, in Cerritos. James is the perfect book, right? And then it's this perfect connecting piece from the end of the summer to Christmas, which is like only like 3-4 Sundays away in terms of Advent. It's crazy. But so we picked James. And it's like, man, I think James is like taking us to school every Sunday. One Sunday, it's, Mark, watch your mouth. Mark, don't play favorites. Mark, make sure your life lines up with your faith. And then this morning, James starts off with this like short, sarcastic, harsh little phrase. And he says, now listen, you who say. He's kind of got that tone in him. And scholars, you know, they debate, okay, is James, is he addressing Christians here? Is he addressing non-Christians here? There's a whole debate about that if you read commentaries. Whatever. I'm of the opinion, I'm actually pretty convinced he is talking to Christians in this passage. I think that's actually pretty clear. But regardless, that doesn't really matter. Because what James is getting at, the audience that he's talking to, is a bunch of traveling merchants who were self-confident, who were deliberate. Merchants, kind of a archaic word maybe in some ways. Just think of it as modern-day businessmen and businesswomen. Okay, business people who are traveling around. This is who James is talking to. And he rehashes a quote that's going around kind of in the marketplace that people were saying all the time, and particularly this group. And the saying was this. He quotes it. Today or tomorrow, we will go to this or that city, spend a year there, carry on business, and make some money. Now, for all you grammar lovers out there, that little phrase that I just read, every single verb in it is in the future tense. Meaning, for this group, they thought that all their plans in the future were already like present realities. They were cemented down. There aren't any, well, for all you more grammar nerds, a conditional clause, which is like an if statement. So if this happens, then we will do this. There's no ifs in this statement. Like they're just saying, we will do this, we will do that, we will do this, and we'll do it this way. It's like cemented down. So they intend to travel. They intend to travel to a foreign city. In the ancient world, traveling not like it is today, it was not safe. You put yourself in jeopardy. So not only are they doing that, but they're saying, oh, well, when we get to this foreign city, we're just going to make a ton of money. So for them, here's what I'm getting at. It's a foregone conclusion where they'll go, when they'll go, how they'll get there, and then for them, most importantly, they're absolutely certain that they're going to gain a profit from their venture. So I'm reading this. I still kind of think this when I read it. And I'm like, what's wrong with that? Like, that's actually a pretty good, healthy, strategic business people for you, right? Like, we should make plans and I think we should stick to them if it's a good plan, right? If it's not, then, you know, toss it out the window. You know, I got my bachelor's in marketing. I went to business school. I was taught in there, like, you make a plan, just completely strategize, analyze it, and go for it. So I'm reading this, and I'm like, cool. I do the same thing. I do the same thing. And then it kind of struck me in this, and I actually went back to my own kind of journey through business school. And so as a graduating senior in high school, I was coming out of high school, and I completely envisioned myself being a business person. I knew that I was going to get my bachelor's in marketing. I knew that I was going to put on a sleek, stylish suit every single day. I'm going to walk to a tall skyscraper in an urban city, LA or New York City or something. I'm going to take the elevator up there. I'm going to make a ton of presentations to corporate executives. And I'm going to walk out making a ton of money. That was me. That was my plan. And I think I had every reason to believe that. I had good grades. I was driven. I was ambitious. Sky's the limit. And then my freshman year of college, at the end, that all came crumbling down, and I got this tug to go into pastoral ministry, and I kissed all the money goodbye. See, plans are good, but they're not God. And James isn't telling us, he's not saying don't plan, right? I mean, let me be clear here this morning. The Bible tells us to plan. Proverbs 21:5, right, this book full of nothing but wisdom and advice says this. It says, the plans of the diligent lead to profit as surely as haste leads to poverty. So what James is getting at, he's saying, don't allow your plans to take the place of God. And that's actually a really good reminder. Because if you do that, you're forgetting one pretty fundamental important fact. You're a limited, dependent human being. We don't know the future. So James says, verse 14, he says, "Why, you do not even know what will happen tomorrow." James, I think he's got it easy here. He could have said, you don't even know what's going to happen this afternoon or this evening, let alone tomorrow. So he continues on. He rhetorically asks, he says, what is your life? You are a mist that appears for a little while and then vanishes. As one author describes it, he says, imagine this. He says, think of the mist that you see outside of your window on an autumn morning, right? Kind of just hanging there in the valley above a little stream. We don't have streams here. It's like California. We have cement and dirt instead, or a fake stream. Regardless, think of it that way, or like a postcard, right? It's beautiful. It's mysterious, just like human beings can be. But then the sun comes up a little bit further, and the mist just suddenly disappears. Morning fog, gone. That's what your life is like, he's saying. He's saying, you have no idea what this afternoon, tonight, let alone tomorrow, what it's going to bring. And if you're like me and you hear these words, I cringe. Like, I don't like that. I want to, like, punch James in the face or something. I want to argue with him. I want to say, no, man, you got it wrong. Like, I know what I'm going to do the next 10, 20, 50 years. Like, dependence is a bad word in our culture. You probably didn't feel like super encouraged and excited the last 2-3 minutes when we just talked about this stuff, about us disappearing. Right? We have a holiday where we celebrate our independence. We don't like dependence. We don't like being told that we're limited, finite creatures. We want to rebel against that. And I think the scriptures this morning, they want to remind us that every single one of us, we are completely dependent and we are completely limited. And it's that way naturally. When you're born, you are 100% dependent. I think of Judea,
right? Judea is 100% completely dependent on Harley and Ryan. Then at the end of your life, when you come close to passing away, the days leading up to that, the weeks or months, chances are probably you're 100% completely dependent at that point too. And we do this weird thing in American culture where in our middle years, we forget that. And I think it's because we become educated, we become skilled, and we think we become self-reliant. And so we forget that. It kind of just escapes our mind. And part of this is, I think, like James' audience, when you're a middle class, and actually I would go so far as to say that I think every single one of us in here is upper class compared to the world standards, that's easy to forget. If we're honest, life's pretty easy for us. It's easy to forget that you are dependent and limited. If you don't believe me yet, let's do an exercise. Right now, you are 100% dependent on the air circulating around your body. If that air is not there, I don't even know if this is possible, if like all the air could be sucked out of this room. I don't know what any of that means, I'm not a scientist. But we are 100% completely dependent on the air we breathe, completely external to our body. Food and drinks and liquid, you are 100% dependent on that, right? My voice right now, even projecting, is 100% dependent on the batteries in this pack and probably Jason. He smiles right now. Right? We're actually naturally dependent like all the time. If I don't eat, if I don't drink, I don't know, 2-3 days, whatever it is, I'm done. And I'll get grouchy probably after a couple hours. Right? And maybe you're thinking, okay, but you know what, Mark, but I work, I accomplish things, I achieve things, like I am responsible for a lot of stuff in my life. Oh, absolutely. So I'm not saying that either, right? I have a job, I work, that gives me money, that allows me to buy a bed to sleep on, a car to transport me, food and drinks to buy, all those things. So there is an element where like I am in control and things are dependent on me. Absolutely. Take a step further back though. All those things that allow you to do that, my brain, my IQ, however low it may be, completely not dependent on me. I didn't choose my brain. I didn't choose the century that I was born in. I was born in the 20th century with the advent of technology that I use all the time. Not up to me. I was born in America, a blessed and fortunate country, the ton of freedom. Not up to me. Right? There are so many things in our lives that are completely not up to you that you are completely dependent upon. I actually would say most things. So we're like fish. Like, what the heck? Fish? Where does this come from? This dude just called me a fish this morning. We're like fish. Think about a fish. They live in water, right? I mean, a fish probably doesn't even know that they live in water because they don't know anything outside of water, right? They are completely dependent on water, and they probably don't even know it. And so, you know, when you go fishing and you get a fish and you take it out of the water and it flops around and does all this stuff and you try to hold it and it's crazy, you know, after a couple of minutes, what will happen? Well, the fish is going to die. A fish is completely dependent on water. May not even know it because that's all it knows. Here's my point. Fish are most free when they're most dependent. I think that's the same thing with us and God. Our dependence on God is inescapable, and we may not even realize it. It's inevitable. The problem, though, is that we tend to forget that. And when you forget God, you naturally begin to assume his place. And we begin to make all these plans as if they're future realities, right? We know it's going to happen. We're going to do this. And then guess what happens? You become arrogant. You become boastful. Completely natural, actually. It makes sense. If we live that way and I'm making all these plans and I make things happen, yeah, I have every reason. It makes sense to become arrogant and boastful. That's what James is getting at here, verse 16 and 17. We'll come back to verse 15. James writes, he says, "You boast in your arrogant schemes. All such boasting is evil." And these people, they're planning their lives independently of God's guidance, and so they're bragging about it. And it's not only that they've left God outside of their plans, although that's kind of like the first strike, right? But they're bragging about it. And they're replacing God with themselves. And they know better. That's why I actually think this passage is written to Christians. Is because of verse 17. James says, "If anyone then knows the good they ought to do and doesn't do it, it's sin for them." Classic James, calling it for what it is. Sin. Here's the point of all of this. It's actually quite ironic. Not only are these people or us, when we plan like this, not only are we sinning, but we're replacing God with our plans, and we actually enslave ourselves. We are most free when we're most dependent on God. It actually goes against you. And so if you want true freedom, give up your control. And it's not just giving up your control to like blind fate or some hippie lifestyle, or, you know, Lion King Hakuna Matata, nothing to worry about, I'm just going to kind of go with wherever the wind goes. No, no, no. Like, you're releasing control to the creator of the universe. And so James outlines this for us. He gives us the blueprint for planning. And here's where we're going to land, verse 15. He says, "Instead, you ought to say," or "you ought to plan by saying, if it's the Lord's will, then we will live or do this or do that." But did you catch what he did there at first? He said, "If it's the Lord's will, then you will live." Like, James doesn't even hit on like business plans for these traveling merchants first. He says, "No, no, no, no. If it's the Lord's will, you'll live every single day for us." And Ryan said in his prayer, we didn't script it, is the sheer grace and goodness of God. We are the fish in the water. Our human limitations actually make for a divine invitation. And he isn't saying by this that every time you make plans, like, you have to say out loud, "All right, well, if it's the Lord's will, then I'll do this." Right? A couple examples. Growing up, I had a guy mentor me. Great guy. Hopefully he never watches this. I'm not going to say his name. I'll say his name's John. That's not his name. So John and I, every time we would make plans, let's say we make a plan to go to Starbucks, 8 a.m. Well, John would email me back or text me with, "Okay, Mark, I'll see you there if the Lord wills." And every single time, though, "Hey, John, I'll see you at the baseball park tomorrow if the Lord wills, Mark." And I was just like, "Dude, come on, bro. Like, we know we're going to see each other there." Right? It annoyed me. Still does. I'm passionate about it. Second example, I know people, like, when they go shopping, like Target, Nordstrom's, wherever you go shopping, you know, and they pick up a shirt and they just kind of stand there for a couple minutes and, like, they just don't know if they should buy it or not. And it's like, you know, let me just put that down, pause for a little bit. Let me just pray real quick to God. "God, do you want me to buy this shirt? Is this going to lead to a conversion of your people next week?" Right? I mean, like, we ask, I know people that do that, and I am kind of making fun of and mocking those examples a little bit, so I want to be a little careful, and there is maybe a grain of truth in that. But what I'm getting at is James, he isn't giving some, like, magic formula, you know, a way to, like, manipulate God, treat God like a vending machine where if you press the right button, then the right soda will come out. No, no, that's not what's going on here. What James is getting at is like your fundamental disposition, who you are, Do you depend upon God for your plans? In other words, like, do you make space? Do you spend time in prayer seeking God's will? God, what do you want me to do? And what I think he's really getting at is this question. Are you willing to have the Lord interrupt your plans? And see, this actually brings freedom when we depend upon God for our plans, because you don't have to have all the answers. And I think practically speaking, so many of us deal with anxiety and fear and frustration, and we're afraid constantly every single day because we want things just to be perfect. We want to be entirely successful and profitable, and I get it. That's me. I'm there. But I think we're most afraid when we begin to lose control. And so when things don't go perfectly, when they don't go your way, you lose it. You freak out. Life's over. And I think I've shared this story of mine, I think maybe a couple months ago. There was a pivotal experience in my life about 5 years ago. I got these crazy physical and neurological symptoms. I had tingling in my hands. I had headaches. I had dizziness. So I went to the doctor, right? Ended up going to the neurologist. Like, okay, what's going on? This is really weird. So they tested me for a bunch of things, right? One of the things that they tested me for was multiple sclerosis, MS. And man, once I heard that, I went home, I Googled it, and I tripped out. My life was paralyzed. I was frozen. Everything that I had thought of in my future, all those plans that I shared of in the beginning, just came crashing down, and I freaked out. I was a nervous wreck. And long story short, didn't end up having MS, completely fine. From what the doctors and I can tell, you know, we think it was actually completely my body reacting to stress, right? And the crazy thing is, as I look back to that, and the very reason probably why I had all that stuff was because I wanted to be in control. Things weren't going my way. I had plans, and they were crumbling down, and so I lost it. And so I was just in this vicious cycle that spiraled down. And what I needed at that point was this posture that says, God, whatever your plans are, I'm here. Let's do it. But instead, I don't want to go that way. And my problem was that my life, and I exaggerated the severity of my condition for sure, but I thought it all just vanished like a mist. And if I had this posture of just dependence and humility and reliance on God, it would have been a different story. And so we don't know the future, but God does. And that's a good thing. I think when we take on this posture, we can roll with the punches of life a little bit easier, actually. It gives you freedom. Take comfort in the fact that your life is in the hands of God and not your own. That's actually probably one of the biggest comforts that you can ever receive. I'm glad that I'm actually not independent and that I can make my own plans from my limited vantage point, because they're not going to work. I don't know the future. I don't know what's going to happen. And so how do we proactively, you know, do this, right? It starts with this posture of humility, dependence, reliance. But I think it's more. And I think James hits on that. So what are some steps that we can take forward to line ourselves up with God's will? And that's what it is, making your plans God's plans. Your will is lined up with God's will. And again, there's nothing wrong with planning. Scripture tells us to plan. Kevin DeYoung, he's a pastor in Michigan. He says this, he says, we should stop thinking of God's will like a corn maze or a bullseye or a tightrope or a choose-your-own-adventure novel. Right? If you knew every detail, every step of your life, well, there's no room for God then. I have faith. You know everything. You become God. I think we all know that we're not God. So no matter what your future plans are, make them. And in those future plans, God wills for you to seek and to glorify him. God's will is this, that you become more and more like Jesus. Acknowledge him in your plans, in your ways. And let me end with this. Spend time in prayer. This is convicting for me. When you pray, do you find yourself, you trying to persuade God of your plans or God radically making and changing your plans? When you read the scriptures, look at the life of Jesus, because you'll see someone who not only says but embodies, not my will but your will. You'll see this common thread throughout the scriptures of people who lose their life to gain it. Freedom. And lastly, planning according to God's will involves others in your life. Are you in a life group? Or what does your life group function as? Right? And we don't just say life groups here at New Life. It's just some like church program. Oh, we've always done it. Small groups are a thing of the church. No, that's why, then who cares? Life groups are a value because you can't do life alone. Because you're limited, dependent, and finite. But God often speaks to us through other people. And so when you plan, you need to bounce that off other people. You need to get their wisdom and input. So are your friends, are your neighbors, your coworkers, your family, people in your life group, people in your community, do they always affirm your plans? Or sometimes do they affirm them, but do they also challenge and push back on them? That's actually someone who loves you and cares for you. I have my own shortcomings. I'm blind to my weaknesses. I'm blind to my plan making. I need people to step into me. So remember, there is freedom when we depend upon God. If you want true freedom, release your control to Jesus. Best decision you'll ever make. Guarantee you. And we don't have to have all the answers because our human limitations make for a divine invitation. And so I'm gonna invite the music team back up at this point.